as we devote 2 days of our lives to discussing the temple in South Asia, let me begin by asking a simple question. What exactly is a temple? And even more importantly, are the terms in South Asian languages that correspond to the English temple? Are there terms in South Asian languages that correspond to the English term temple? And if so, how they are similar to or different from what we mean by temple? The New Oxford English Dictionary gives several definitions of temple that hint at the complexity underlying this seemingly simple term. It says, and I quote, number one, an edifice or place regarded primarily as the dwelling place of a deity. And number two, historically applied to the sacred buildings of the Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, and other ancient nations. Now, to those of Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, Shintoism, and other ethnic religions generally, unquote. The OED also adds that the term refers to the Jewish sacred edifice at Jerusalem, presumably not at other places, and to places of worship of Mormons in America, and in France to Protestant places of worship as distinguished from Catholic. This is very interesting in that this simple word has taken on the function of establishing and defining identities. We do not speak of Christian temples. Temple at some level seems to identify the other and the worship of the other in the same way as the term idol with regard to representations of the divine. You never hear of Catholic idols in Catholic temples. We have a similar defining of identities in a statement in the Mahabharata, 3:188-64-16:7, that contrasts a structure called Eduka to Deva Griha, the former probably referring to Buddhist stupas, and the second to a Brahmanical shrine or temple. The proliferation of Edukas and the decline in support of Deva Grihas are given by the Mahabharata as sure signs of the end of a yuga. The identity game is evident in the use of temple, becomes clear when we look at a book of synonyms. For temple, we have church, synagogue, mosque, pagoda, sanctuary, shrine, dargaba, chapel, ashram, cathedral, basilica, and the list goes on. As we can see, each of these terms carries nuances of meaning and a whole lot of cultural baggage. The question we need to keep in mind as we explore the Sanskrit vocabulary is whether similar identities are embedded in the Sanskrit use of terms. So when we talk about a temple in South Asia, what are we talking about? A small roadside shrine or a monument like those of Khajuraho or Madurai? What kind of a physical structure did it have? What kind of religious or public use? What kind of activities took place there? What kind of social prestige did it enjoy? To which segment of the population did it cater? Did it have a sectarian affiliation? In other words, with the umbrella term temple, are we running the risk of talking about apples and oranges and obliterating the differences? If you go to the South Asian terms for temple, and here specifically to Sanskrit, the vocabulary is somewhat restricted, especially when we compare it to English. Limiting myself to the Sanskrit legal literature, which I will do today, which is the Dharma Shastras and to some degree the Artha Shastra, we encounter 6 or maybe 8 terms, all compounded with a term for a house or residence. The most common are Devayatana and Devathayatana, with 13 occurrences in these texts, and Devagriha with 13 occurrences, followed by Devalaya with 2, Devagara with 1, and Devakula with 1. It is interesting to note that Devalaya occurs for the first time in the Vaikarnasa Dharma Sutra, a somewhat late text probably of the 6th or 7th centuries. And Devagara occurs for the first time in the Vishnu Smriti, again a text composed in Kashmir around the 7th century CE. A more ancient term is Devakula, found 3 times in the Kama Sutra and only once in the Artha Shastra. So we are left with 3 early terms for what we may call a temple: Devayatana and its variant Devathayatana, possibly the most common if you take into account also the epics, and Devagriha. Now these edifices must have had some individuals associated with their construction, upkeep, and activities. The only term I have been able to discover relating to them, these individuals associated with temples, is Devalaka. It is absent in the most ancient legal literature, appearing for the first time in Manu 3, 152 and 180. The meaning of the term is not altogether clear, but it must refer to a Brahmin who functioned in some way as a priest in a temple. In the rest of the time I have, I want to examine both the meaning of these terms within their context and the role these edifices play in the legal and political institutions and the religious life presented in the Sanskrit legal literature. First, the structure and function of a temple. Ironically, even though a temple locates the visible presence of the divinity on earth, yet the temple is conspicuous by its absence or insignificance in legal literature of ancient India. It is important to note that in the oldest of the legal texts, the Apastamba Dharma Sutra, going back probably to the 3rd century BCE, any reference to a temple is totally absent. The word for temple does not occur either in Panini's 4th century BCE grammar, or more significantly in the 2nd century BCE, the commentary on Panini by Patanjali, the Mahabhashya, which is generally a mine of information on cultural phenomena of the period. The first text to note the temple is the Gautama Dharma Sutra, which refers once to a Devatayatana. Baudhayana also refers to a Devagriha once, and Vasishta, the last of the Dharma Sutras, uses the term twice and Devatayatana once. Even when these terms begin to be used, they are not central to the argument of the documents. These terms are referred to in passing in the context of other discussions. In the religious life of a good Brahmin, which is the central focus of these texts, the temple or anything resembling it plays no significant or even secondary role. This, of course, should come as no surprise. The legal literature on dharma follows the path of the Vedic ritual life, in which no public structure of worship or ritual played any role. The public rituals of the Shrauta sacrifices were performed in temporary structures whose construction itself was part of the larger ritual. The domestic rites found in the Grihya Sutras, moreover, were performed within the confines of the home. There is no archaeological evidence for temples, and here I am on thin ice, for temples in what could be termed the mainstream Brahminical tradition, as opposed to the Buddhist or the Jain, until at least the time of the Kushanas. Correct me if I'm wrong. This is in line with the first mention of a ritual specialist, the Devalaka, connected with temples by Manu, a text that I think dates to the Kushana period. Gautama says that while traveling, a man should do a pradakshina to various significant objects he encounters, among them a Devatayatana. Coming immediately before Chatushpata, that is a crossroads, it appears that here Devatayatana is a roadside shrine, the kind we see even today in India. That they may have been located strategically near a crossroads, much like today's petrol stations, seems logical enough to attract the largest number of visitors. In a similar context, Manu tells a traveler to circumambulate, among other things and persons, a daivata. Here, as in other places that we will look at, a daivata probably refers either to an image of a god or more likely to some sort of a shrine. Manu also lists crossroads and notable trees, Prajnathan, Vanaspatin, along with Daivata. We have a similar abbreviation in Vijayanavalkya, a text that comes after Manu, 3 or 4 centuries after Manu, where a traveler is asked to circumambulate Deva Mridgo Vipra Vanaspatin, where Deva clearly stands for Devatayatana or Devagriha. Vasishta lists Devagriha among the places from which one should not gather soil for use in bodily purification, again indicating a place outside the village. These passing references suggest that temples and shrines were small structures located along roads and removed from human habitations. The other places where this term is used also support the conclusion that the references are to small structures by the side of a road or even within a house. Manu, for example, includes an old dilapidated temple among the places where one should not urinate. A place of urination is generally away from homes and habitations. We have a similar provision in the Vaikarnasa Dharma Sutra, where among places one is forbidden to void urine or excrement is listed a devalaya. The Arthashastra lists fines for voiding feces at, among other places, a devagriha. Manu, speaking of the king establishing boundary markers between villages and between fields, gives a list of suitable markers including many kinds of large trees, reservoirs, wells, ponds, waterways, and Devatayatana. Here again, one is inclined to think that this Devatayatana is a small shrine located at the edge of a village rather than a large temple. We have similar provisions in other legal texts, such as that of Brihaspati. There is also the possibility that sometimes Devatayatana may refer to a shrine room within a house. Vasishtha, for example, gives a provision for a Shraddha when only one Brahmin is attending. Normally, there should be a separate Brahmin for the offerings to the gods. In this case, Vasishtha says that the food for the gods should be placed at the Devatayatana. Now, such a place could be outside the house. However, Vasishtha continues that after the Shraddha is over, that food should be given to a Vedic student or thrown in the fire, making it likely that the Devatayatana was in or near the house. A clear indication that the Devatayatana may be located within a house is found in the Kama Sutra, where among the duties of a good housewife are listed 3 Shavanarchita Balikarma and Pujita Devatayatana, making sure that the Bali offering is made 3 times a day and divine worship is in the Devatayatana is carried out. These texts, however, provide little information about what an actual Devatayatana may have looked like or what social or religious function it may have had. The exceptions are the passages of Vasishtha and the Kama Sutra that hint at the offering of food to the deities and the performance of puja, although elements of that puja are left unstated. There are passages, however, especially in younger texts, that gives us some idea about the physical extent of these buildings. Baudhayana, for example, says that one should wash one's feet before entering a cemetery, water, a cow pen, and a devagraha. Clearly, the devagraha here in juxtaposition with a temple and a cow pen must have been a place with a sufficiently large interior to permit one or more persons to enter. In the Vishnu Smriti, a Kashmiri text, as we have said, there are also several passages indicating that the devagraha and Devatayatana were actual buildings with somewhat large interiors. At 3015, it says that Vedic recitation is suspended in a Devatayatana. He must not engage in Vedic recitation in a temple, cemetery, crossroads, or a road. Given that the list includes cemetery, crossroads, or road, it is unclear whether the recitation is suspended in or near a Devatayatana. In other passages, the meaning is clear. One is not permitted to eat in a devagara, to have sex in a devayatana, or to sleep in a devatayatana. These passages imply that there were buildings in which these sorts of activities could take place. The clearest indication that devatayatana was a place that people could enter to worship a deity is found not in a Brahmanical, but a Buddhist text from the 1st or 2nd century CE, Ashvaghosha's Buddha Charita. After Siddhartha had left home, his father Suddhodana performs vows and does japa in the Devatayatana. Later in the text, we encounter the king coming out of the Devayatana. Ashvaghosha's Devayatana was a building within the palace ground, however, and not a public structure corresponding somewhat to that of the Kama Sutra. Temple as a social institution. In the early Dharmashastric texts, we get little information about the social or religious function of these structures. They do not form part of the social, religious, or legal system, and they are mentioned only in passing. Much of the information we get is in the form of obita dicta. Especially in normative texts, however, obita dicta are much better sources of historical information because they do not aim at either legal or didactic instruction. At least within the legal system, legal texts of the Dharmashastric tradition, the first thing to note is that no activities recommended or enjoined by these texts are meant to take place within a temple. The temple, as I have noted, is conspicuous by its absence within the religious or social activities depicted in these texts. Dharmashastric religious life was centered on the individual and in the home. There is, however, one exception. It is unclear whether we are dealing here with a temple at all, although. And this is the word that is used is Parishkanda, said that where tapas performed in a Parishkanda is more effective, but it is unclear whether Parishkanda actually forms a temple, and I will skip that passage. Apart from this ambiguous and uncertain location, the most common religious function of a devatayatana given in these texts relates... 5 minutes, yes, okay. That's to 20, right? All right. Apart from this ambiguous and unclear location, the most common religious function of a devatayatana given in these texts relates to a place where wandering ascetics are depicted, are expected to spend the night. The first to note is the Vasishta Dharma Sutra, where we find the list Grama Simanta, Devagriha Shunyagara, and Vrikshamula. It is interesting to note in this connection that all the places listed in this passage are far from human habitation, which raises interesting questions about the geography of temples during this period. In all likelihood, they were located far from villages and towns, at least that is the imagined geography of the temples in these texts. When we turn to non-dharmashastric legal tradition represented by the Arthashastra, however, we get a different and perhaps a more complete picture of some of the social roles the early temples in India may have played. Some of its provisions also support the picture given in the Dharma text that temples were located in isolated places. The king, for example, is instructed to have his secret agents operate in woods, cemeteries, holy sites, and devagriha, and arrest anyone loitering there with wounds, weapons, and the like. Temples are here assumed to be isolated and lonely places where criminal elements of society may have gathered and where nefarious plots may have been hatched. This picture is confirmed by a comment from another law text from around the middle of the first millennium CE, that of Narada, which gives a list of places where thieves normally gather and where the king should employ spies. The list includes crossroads, chaitya trees, vacant houses, forests, and devatayatana. The Arthashastra also makes it clear that at least some of these temples were rich and were of sufficient social and political significance for the king to appoint a superintendent called devatadhyaksha. Here we find again the interesting abbreviation of devatayatana to simply devata. Significantly, devatadhyaksha is first mentioned in a long list of activities and offices that would bring in income to the fort. These activities include custom duties, etc. But at least part of the temple officer's duties was to bring in income from the temple to the treasury. How this was done is left unstated. Was it some type of taxation, a percentage of temple's income? The only explicit statement in the context of is in the context of confiscation of property when the king's treasury is depleted. Under these circumstances, the overseer of temples is expected to gather the treasures belonging to the devatas of fort and countryside and bring them to the treasury. The deities, namely temples, controlled wealth is assumed in several Arthashastra passages. The king is instructed, for example, to seize devadravya, that is not intended for use by learned Brahmins, as also Pashanda Sangha Dravya, property belonging to various heretical sects. This juxtaposition is interesting in that a legal parallel is drawn between the property of two moral entities, temple and monastery. The term devadravya is used several times in the Arthashastra with reference to temple property. All of these nevertheless points to temple establishments with considerable endowments. Thus, the administrator Samaharta, one of the highest ranking officials of the state, is asked to divide the countryside into four divisions to make a census of villages, etc., and then among the fields to make a census of the temples. It is apparent that there are also individuals or communities associated with temples who would fight to protect the interests of the temples. Thus, the Arthashastra speaks of disputes brought before the court concerning Devakula, here clearly referring to a public temple rather than a domestic shrine. There may have been slaves or persons working full-time for a temple is hinted at in several discussions of the superintendent of yarn, who is advised to get yarn spun by women in dire straits. Among these are temple slave women who have ceased performing temple services. More recent Dharma texts list a temple among works of charity that would produce merit for its benefactor. Vishnu Dharma Sutra has a long section on that. The only place where the legal literature of Dharma tradition recognizes that temples had a liturgical function is the discussion of an officer that we talked about already, Devalaka. These functionaries were in all likelihood Brahmins employed as liturgical specialists at temples. They were despised by the authors of the Dharma texts, and in all likelihood by the smarts, the Brahmanical tradition represented by them. The Devalaka is listed among those who should not be fed at a Shraddha, coming immediately after a physician and a butcher. We have the same provision in the Vishnu Smriti. Manu also listed Devalaka among those who are not Patrins, that is, people who are fit to receive gifts. Some conclusions, and let me take 1 minute here. What can we conclude about the temple in the early centuries of the Common Era from these textual references? First, there is the uncertainty about the vocabulary that we have already talked about. Further investigation is needed to see whether they are simply synonyms or whether they acquire, at least in some sources, more specific meanings with regard to their structure, location, and sectarian affiliation. What distinctions, if any, were made between Deva and Devata in this context, and between Ayatana, Griha, Agar, and Kula, and Koshta? This question must be left unanswered until a more thorough and detailed analysis of the terms, both in these and other contemporary texts, can be made. Beyond the vocabulary, however, we can draw some tentative conclusions and observations on the basis of the data we have reviewed. One, the temple, whether a large public structure or a small roadside shrine, did not play any significant role in the religious life depicted and promoted by the Dharma Shastras. The evidence is mixed with regard to the physical structure of the temple. Many texts seem to suggest that they were roadside shrines, probably small structures, others indicating that they had interiors large enough for people to enter. Three, the information provided by the Arthashastra shows that some of these temples were well endowed and had property, animals, and other valuables that could be targeted by both robbers and treasury officials of the king. Four, temples had ritual specialists attached to them. One such specialist is referred to in our text under the title Devalaka. Five, and last, although the Arthashastra speaks of temples within the fort, the general assumption in these texts is that temples were located far from human habitation, making them ideal places for both wandering ascetics and for criminal elements of society. Evidence of the Dharma Shastra contrasts sharply with that of the Arthashastra, even though they come from roughly the same period. While in the Dharma Shastra the temple is conspicuous by its absence, in the Arthashastra at least some temples are introduced as strong and well-endowed social institutions. This shows once again the pitfalls of depending on a single slice of literary data to uncover the social history on the ground. Most frequently, only a tiny window is opened into the social reality by these texts, a window that is controlled by the interests and biases of those responsible for their production. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that very stimulating talk. Series of very concrete conclusions. There is time for about 5 minutes worth of questions.
Hi, Patrick. I was just wondering on two accounts. One is, you mentioned that the texts say that the temple should be located away from, either a roadside shrine or away from settlement.
It doesn't say that, but it assumes that, I would say.
Assumes that.
Yes.
Okay. But if one looks at Mathura, for example, the earliest evidence of a temple, and there's a city there. So clearly, there is a sort of distinction in the way in which the Dharma Shastras or the Arthashastras, you pointed out the differences between them, but also the way they are looking or they're presenting a perception.
I think it's an imagined geography, basically, we're talking about here.
Okay.
And in that imagination, it seems to be somewhere else. That doesn't mean that there weren't texts within. In fact, in the construction of the fort, if you look at the chapter on the construction of a fort in the Arthashastra, the temples, or what they call the koshtas, are listed. So there were within the fort also some kind of structures.
Yeah.
They didn't say exactly how large, etc., within. So yes, it is ambiguous.
And the second point then is that, also when you get the inscriptions from about the 5th century, there are differential rules for taxation. And does that happen or does it not happen? That if it's for a religious shrine, then, a different percentage has to be taxed in revenue.
Right.
Where if it's for ordinary, so does that at all figure?
I have not seen a single reference in the tax sections of either Artha or the Dharma Shastras with regard to taxation of temple property. There is a provision for taxation of Brahmin's property, which is not taxed.
But with regard to a temple, on the other hand, it's not, except that the Archdeacon said you can go and steal it. No. and they give various ways in which you can say that this particular temple was part of a criminal gang and you can take it over there. You know? I mean, there are very subterfuges here.
I'm just wondering what you mentioned about Devalokas.
Yes.
And if they were such an important class associated with the temple, as you know, you said that they were sort of masters of texts, etc. Why are there so many restrictions placed that you should not feed them, and why are they sort of treated as a kind of inferior?
The Brahmins who are composing our text, the text that I'm studying, are completely against those people. So we are talking about two different traditions of Brahmins coming.
Okay.
What Devalokas did, we don't have any text from the Devalaka side.
Right.
So we see only them from one side, yes.
I mean, is that possible that these were actually people who were associated with the temple in a lesser capacity, singers and dancers? That's what happens in my temple in Goa, for example.
Right. It could very well...
The whole community is called Devalis, who are associated with the temple, and they usually...
It could well be, but the only...
Music and
It could well, but the only problem is that there is no other kind of liturgical specialist listed in this.
Okay.
So basically, temples are completely absent, except in a negative way, in this particular way.
Okay.
So it seems that the people who are writing these texts were at least guys who were not very fond of temples or part of that, of that scene, yes.
There is another name of a temple functionary is called Pujak. In an inscription of 882 from Haryana region of a temple of Yagna Varaha.
Right.
So there is a Pujaka and he has also been given grant.
I mean, I'm not talking about inscriptions here at all,
okay.
Naturally, you know.
Okay.
But the Pujaka is not, the word doesn't occur in the
Dharma. Yeah, Pujaka is also there.
Yeah.
And also from 2nd century BC, we get evidence of temples in the depictions on Sanchi, Bharut and other places. Temples mean some sort of shrines of Nagas, Yakshas.
Right. Yes, certainly. Yes.
Coins, those coins of Audumbara.
I was going to say that I thought one of the most interesting passages in your paper had to do with what you described as the abbreviation of Devatayatana to Devata, especially in the context of offerings to or income by that person.
Mm-hmm.
Just thought that was perhaps worth flagging as something that is maybe more than abbreviation, actually, but an identification that is worth noticing as such. The temple stands for the deity rather than the deity being an abbreviation for the temple, except perhaps in the minds of the writers of these texts.
It's as interesting to think about, right? Yes, yeah. John?
I really enjoyed your paper in terms of the way you kind of lay out sort of the earliest. Within these Brahmanical texts that we can date temples. And I'm wondering, because there are, Kane and von Stietenkorn have talked about how there are earlier references from about the middle of about 300-400 BC to images in a variety of texts, including Panini and various others. Would you be willing to therefore imply that perhaps icons predated temples? Or do you not want to imply that today? Because I was struck that your discussion was all about temples, but not what the temples enshrine, their icons.
Yeah.
We do need to distinguish those.
Right, absolutely. I'm not a visual expert. As you can see, I don't have anything on there. So it's difficult for me to mention. I'm sure there are a lot of experts here who can answer that.
It's a purely textual question.
Right. The images, especially pratima, for example, the term, occurs more frequently in later texts. The text that has it most frequently is Vishnu Smriti, which clearly is a Vaishnava text and Pancharatra text and etc. So the whole thing is surrounding that. But in the earlier texts, I'm not now talking at the top of my head, without having done any research. I cannot think of any place where an image of a god plays any significant role, or whether even one is mentioned, I'm not sure. That doesn't mean they didn't exist. I mean, you must realize we are looking at a very thin slice of texts, and what we read there is what they thought was important. And the only conclusion we can draw from that is that I don't think they thought these things were important enough to record. That's the only conclusion that we can draw here. Sanju. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. It's a very interesting conversation developing here, but we're going to have to cut it short and proceed. Thank Professor Olivelle for his